So as you watch the animation of the little AC generator there, you can kind of imagine a physical dynamo, a big generator. One of the things that they sometimes do with big generators is they mount the shafts vertically. There's bearings at the top, and then the generator, the shaft goes vertically down into the floor of the building, and down inside the next level below, there's this big mass of rotor that has copper coils and things on it, and way down many levels below is a big turbine where the water from the dam is diverted into this thing to get it to spin. Now, imagine that you're back on the top floor and all you see is the end of the generator, you know, the rear end of it. And imagine that this is a really, really big generator, okay? This generator is so big that the polished end of the shaft that's sticking out of the bearing, the flat surface that is the end of the shaft, this thing is so big, it's 6 feet in diameter, just the end of the shaft alone. Now imagine that you're standing on this shaft. Now relate standing on the end of this shaft, which is rotating. You know, you're spinning around, it's getting a dizzy, right? Imagine you point yourself in the direction that the vector that's in the animation is pointing. Now, you're looking in the direction of the voltage, the zero phase voltage that this generator is producing. You might be getting really dizzy, and as you look out in this direction, you see the world around you is whirling, you know. I mean, the building that you're in is spinning around because you're actually spinning around within it, and so your worldview at this point, or at least the view of the building around you, is kind of whirling around. But the vector that draws the sine wave in that animation, the vector is the direction where you're looking. Now, you can't see the vector. It's not anything you can really look at. But it's imaginary, but you can imagine yourself sitting on this shaft and knowing that there is a voltage vector out there, you know, straight out in front of you, you know, starting at your feet and going out so many volts. And, it, you know, if someone were charting a sine wave, that vector would be doing a nice, neat job of charting a sine wave. I mean, of course, from your point of view, you'd be rotating around, and this guy, you know, who's winding up this great big long sheet of paper with a pen on it hooked up to the vector is probably going to, you know, be kind of whirling around you as well. But from your point of view, that vector is a fixed direction. It's a fixed thing. It's always the same distance out. It has a constant value, even though from the point of view of the real world, the world that isn't standing on this end of this shaft spinning, the voltage is constantly in a state of flux tracing out a sine wave. But from your point of view, the magnitude of that vector is a fixed distance from you, and it's always pointing out in the direction where you're looking. We're assuming, of course, you've aligned yourself, you know, it pointing your face toward the exact direction that the vector is pointing. Well, that's a convenient way to deal with AC. You're saying, well, I know that it's a certain magnitude. You know, this vector here is a certain value. I know that it's a certain distance away, and it's not going to change. The voltage that the generator actually produces, or the sine wave that gets carved out as a result of this, is a constantly changing voltage. Some of the times it's positive voltage, sometimes it's negative voltage, but that's instantaneous. From your point of view, the aggregate voltage that can be represented as a vector that's a certain distance from you, and it has an angle that's constantly rotating. But from your point of view, you're standing on the end of the shaft with the generator. So you're looking out, and the angle of that thing is fixed. We're going to call that fixed angle zero, or it's going to be our reference phase. That's going to be zero. Okay? That is the basis by which vectors are thought of when you're trying to do vector math calculations. You know that this thing is in fact rotating, at whatever the frequency of the thing is, whatever the frequency of the generator is. You know that this is happening, but as you look out from your point of view, that vector can be thought of as a fixed number. Okay? It's the voltage of the generator. Now, it may be true that it's dependent on a lot of things, like the rotational speed of the generator controls its frequency, and to some degree its amplitude. But we're talking about a fixed frequency, and so the generator is rotating at a given rate. It's not going to change, and so the analogy of you standing on the end of the shaft looking out, what you would see if you were able to see this vector is a fixed length vector. Basically, it's starting at your feet, going out some distance, and it's got an arrowhead on the end of it for convenience. Okay? Now, capacitors, reactive elements in general, capacitors and inductors tend to do very strange things with AC. Capacitor doesn't like to accept voltage change across it, and its dislike for this manifests itself in current that flows. Well, since this is AC, it's a sine wave, it's continuously changing, the effect is that the current that flows through a capacitor that's connected across the generator is 90 degrees away from the vector that the voltage is applied. And so it leads the current that flows through the thing, leads it by 90 degrees. Okay? So what we like to think of when we try and do vector arithmetic on this stuff is we like to think of the capacitor and the inductor as being in the vertical plane, the vertical number line, okay, and that the reference phase that we start with is in the horizontal number line. The capacitor is always a negative or downward vector. It's a magnitude of capacitive reactance. I should get into that. You've probably already picked up on this from earlier lessons, but capacitive reactance is at a given frequency, a capacitor creates the illusion of a resistance in that it behaves Ohm's law. It has a certain capacitive reactance at a given frequency. Change the frequency, and the capacitor won't have the same reactance, the same capacitor. So as you go up and down in frequency, the capacitive reactance will change. Again, this is all based on the notion that the generator is rotating at a given fixed speed or a given fixed frequency. In the inductor, an inductance has an inductive reactance also, and so at any given fixed frequency, the inductive reactance will be the same for that frequency for calculations within it. So if you want to work with inductances and reactances, you first of all, in order to do vector math on them, you have to assign a frequency that you're going to use. But once you've done that, you can now compute the inductive reactance, and you can compute the capacitive reactance. And of course, a resistor is still a resistor. It has a resistance. There is no phase with it. If you look at the way that I've laid out in Figure 1, capacitance is shown in blue, pointing downward, i.e. a negative angle. Why do I call that a negative angle? When you look at the generator, these things rotate in a counterclockwise direction. Cartesian coordinate plane, you start out, you've got a reference angle that points to the right, and when it points to the right, that's 0 degrees, and as you go upward toward 90, going counterclockwise, then you reach maximum at 90, and then you continue counterclockwise in the negative direction for resistance, which you really can't have, but we'll ignore that for a moment, and you continue on around to where you get to the capacitive 90 degree difference, and it, by the way, is at that point 270 degrees, and then you wrap back to 360. Well, another way to look at that is to say, rather than calling capacitance 270 degrees, which makes your calculations awful, just think of it as a negative angle, okay? When you look at, in the left frame of figure 1, the Z angle in the vector that's formed by the Z magnitude, the Z angle in that is a vector that is pointing with a negative angle, i.e. pointing clockwise with respect to the reference phase. The R does not stand for reference phase. The R stands for resistance. In other words, these are trying to talk about computing either reactances or resistances, and so L, inductive reactance, is pointing upward at a positive 90 degrees. Capacitance, a pure capacitance, is pointing downward in blue, whereas the inductance I show in red for convenience. The capacitance in blue points downward to negative 90 degrees. And then I add some resistance in black. When you add vectors, you start out with a rise component and a run component for any given vector. In the case of X sub C, pure X sub C, a pure capacitive reactance, the blue line has no resistive component in it. The blue line is just a magnitude in the vertical axis, in this case a negative magnitude in the vertical axis. You go from the reference, the origin, you go from the origin down whatever the X sub C magnitude is, and then if it's in series with a resistor, you then can add, just like you do whenever you're trying to find total resistance in Ohm's law or any of those kinds of things, whenever you're trying to figure series resistance, you add the two. Well, in this case, you add the vectors. So you go down maybe 10 units, and then you go horizontally, the black line, you go horizontally maybe 6 units, and you end up with a total magnitude that starts at the origin and ends at the termination point, which I show as a white dot. Z magnitude is the length of that vector that's described by those two other vectors, the total, and the angle is then the trigonometric angle that you would get, or the geometric angle that you would get if you measured from the reference phase to the line that forms the magnitude. Okay, moving right along, inductive reactance is much the same, except that the angle is a positive angle. By the way, X sub C is, if you're talking rise and run, I should discuss this. Rise and run calculations say I've got so much X, so much Y, so much X. In this case, Y, the vertical axis, is negative for X sub C. So you have a negative 10, let's say, and a resistance of 6. So you got a total of, I don't know what it is off the top of my head. But anyway, that's where you, well, actually I do. It's right on the next frame. How convenient. So you end up with a total of 11.6619 and an angle of 59 degrees. Or you could refer to that same thing. There's no difference between referring to that in polar form, which we're getting into figure 2 now. You might as well look at figure 2. The polar form of that is where I quote the magnitude and the angle. The rectangular form of that is where I quote the y-axis and then the x the x-axis component of it. Okay? Moving right along, in figure 3 I show one where you start out with an x sub c, and so we go from the origin down 10 units, then we walk from that position to the right 6 units, and then we add in another series component, the inductor, which has an x sub cell that's equal to x sub c, but since it goes in a positive direction, we now head backwards. We now head up, back to toward the origin, but only in the vertical axis. And what you end up with is a pure resistance. X sub c and x sub cell absolutely cancel each other in real life and in the vector addition. It's very simple. You simply walk all the directions that the vectors tell you to walk, and then you end up somewhere, and the place where you end up is your final destination, and then also you get a magnitude. In this case, it's equivalent to R, and its angle is zero, which is also indicates that it's a pure resistance. On the right half of the panel, we start out with an impedance Z1, which is some combined impedance of both resistive and in this case, capacitive elements. We get to a destination from Z1 to a point that I've created a kind of a hollow circle. And then from there, we go upward with an inductive resistive impedance, and we end up at a final destination, and that, again, these are series impedances. We don't know what's inside the black box. It's some kind of an impedance at this given frequency, and you end up with a Z total, or impedance total, that's the dotted line, and that the magnitude is the length of the dotted line, and the angle is from the white dot back to the horizontal axis, the resistive x-axis. Okay? Now, what does all this mean? Well, let's just look at that last example for just a minute, and imagine that you're standing on the end of this generator. You're looking out in the direction of 0 degrees, or it's straight out in front of you. And you then take these two impedances together, and you wire them in series, and what you end up with is a total impedance that looks like it wants to be an inductive impedance. It wants to be something that, as an impedance, bends a little bit up and mostly straightforward. Okay, in other words, it's not quite resistive. What you end up with, it could have been, like in the left example. The point is, that's what kind of a thing it looks like to you if you're the generator. You apply that load, and that's the kind of a thing that it looks like. Okay, I'm going to get away from this for just a moment to kind of give you a vector addition is pretty easy. You just simply go the direction that all the vectors are, one vector at a time, and you end up at a destination. So series impedances are pretty easy to calculate, although you have to have it in rectangular form in order to do that, because with magnitudes and angles, you can't really do those kinds of calculations. You need it in rise-run components. Well, okay. To do angles, to do multiplication and division, you need magnitude and angle. To do addition, it's rise, run, addition. It's pretty easy. You add up all the rises, you add up all the runs, and then you end up at some final destination. In order to do multiplication and division, you need magnitude and angle. And for the rules for doing multiplication and division, I point you to something that you may or may not have already been familiar with. Scientific notation is composed of a mantissa and then an exponent of 10. So, you know, it's multiplied by an exponent of 10. So whenever you do scientific notation, you write tremendously large numbers down as so many digits of precision, and true scientific notation has a digit followed by a decimal point followed by however many more digits of precision you want. And then there's an exponent of 10 attached, which basically attaching an exponent of 10, you know, multiplying that out, all it means is this is how many decimal places you're going to move this to. Well, this is really great for creating numbers that are like 0.0 and 100 more zeros followed by 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 or something like that. I mean, it is possible to deal with unwieldy numbers. Well, it's possible to deal with them, but there are some rules, and if you're familiar with scientific notation, one of the first things that they show you is how you multiply these. And basically what you do is you add up the exponents. You've got to be careful when you add exponents, you know, that you take into consideration what the sign of the exponent is. If you lose the sign, your decimal place calculations are all screwed up, which makes a vast difference in your result. And then you multiply the mantissas. Okay? And this can allow you to deal with numbers that are way larger than your calculator can handle. Or if you're dealing with a slide rule, it's real handy because you really can't use a slide rule without doing this sort of thing. Very few numbers are between 1 and 10. Okay. Division is similar in its concept. When you divide scientific notation, you subtract the exponent of the denominator from the exponent of the numerator. And so, and then you divide the two mantissas, as I've shown. Well, the reason that I'm telling you all this about scientific notation is that multiplying polar coordinates is much the same. You add up the angles, making sure that you include the signs of these things. You add the angles, and you multiply the magnitudes, and you end up with some resultant magnitude and angle. With division, you do the same kind of thing you did for scientific notation. You subtract the angle of the denominator from the angle of the numerator. In the example I've shown here, that results in a number that is positive because you're subtracting a negative 22 from 45, okay? Yes, you're subtracting, but you also have to pay attention to the sign. And then, of course, you multiply the two numerators. And I mean, you divide the two. You divide the denominator by the numerator, and you end up with the total magnitude. Okay, well, okay. Moving right along to Figure 6. When you have numbers that don't have any angles or anything with them, you just assume that they're a number that has, well, let's say you're going to take the reciprocal of something. You just assume that the 1 has an implied either Y component of zero, or it has an implied angle of zero. And so you can easily convert it to either kind of, you know, polar or rectangular, because it's always going out the true resistive direction or whatever. So then I show an example of doing a pure resonance problem. If you have, remember before, I showed how the X sub C and X sub L in figure 3 cancel each other. There is a pure resistance in that, and so what you end up with is a pure resistance as a result. Well, as it turns out, pure resonance, whenever you're sitting right at a resonant circuit, X sub C and X sub L are exactly balanced. That is, the inductive capacitance and the inductive reactance and the capacitive reactance are exactly the same. And what you end up with in a problem like that is division by zero, which makes it kind of difficult to actually carry out the calculation because you get an error. But you can fiddle things a little bit and at least see where they're going. You won't be able to calculate the actual number, but you can at least see what direction they're going. So if you carry out the calculation as I've shown, but you fiddle things just a little bit, in this case I have taken the capacitive reactance and cranked it down just a smidgen, when you run the calculations, you get this incredibly high number for a magnitude. You get a million. And we started off with 10 ohms for each one of these things. So you get a million. Well, that's a million from the capacitive side. Now, had I done this not to the capacitor, but had I done this to the inductive side, the result would have been, instead of a negative 90 degrees, the result would have been a positive 90 degrees. Now, again, we're adding a smidgen of error, same kind of error, same direction of error, but to the other component. And both of them come up with a million, but instead of a negative, or, you know, a capacitive kind of thing, it becomes a capacitive reactance, it becomes an inductive reactance. And, well, okay, the farther out you go, you start carrying the numbers out farther and farther, and you end up with, the closer you get to true reactance, you start shooting up towards infinity. And I have a thing in your notes about this where I discuss it at length. But basically, this thing is such a high impedance whenever it is truly resonant. It's such a high impedance that you can't even measure it. It draws so little current from your generator that you can't even see it. You can't even tell whether it's a capacitive reactance or an inductive reactance. It's a wisp of current that you can't even measure. So at this point, it doesn't matter that you can't divide by zero, but it's nice to be able to see where this stuff goes. And this is a technique that will let you explore unsolvable problems. Okay, back a little bit to more the real world. I show another example of a resonant circuit in which I have put a resistance in series, a sizable resistance in series with the coil, and I run the numbers. And this is a much more realistic example. If you do this one on your calculator, you actually carry out each one of these steps, converting between polar and rectangular coordinates. I will assume that you have brushed up on using your calculator and you know how to do that. I can't give instructions for that because all calculators do it differently. I could probably do it for each and every one, but that would be silly. Your calculator come with an owner's manual for a reason. They expect you to learn how to do this stuff. at any rate, this is kind of a closer to real world example. And I basically show a series parallel, you know, example here, which has lots of conversions between polar and rectangular. You have to do it both ways, and by doing this example on paper and coming up with the same numbers that I came up with, will get you into the concept of how you set up one of these problems to be able to do a parallel reactance and end up with, and it also will you know, you, that's how you figure out where your mistakes are. You know, you miss a sign, you drop a sign someplace, or you forget to do a conversion someplace, or something like that. Your numbers come out very different, and so I've shown each of the steps in between to kind of help you along. In Figure 10, I show an example of a more real-world example of a resonant circuit, and this one will tax the precision of your calculator, but then real-world resonance tends to do that, because the whole purpose of it is to get an incredibly high impedance in a parallel resonant circuit. Incidentally, if you wire this stuff in series, you end up with the two impedances, the X sub C and X sub L, counteracting each other, and they produce nearly zero result. That would be an interesting exercise for you to try, as to figure this one not as a parallel resonant circuit, but as a series resonant circuit. At any rate, the one that I've drawn you is parallel resonant. And I show a really tiny resistance in series with the X sub C, the capacitive reactance, at 0.28 ohm. 0.28 ohm and 100 ohm X sub C, why did I choose those values? Well, as it turns out, really good capacitors, the better they are, the lower their series resistance. I mean, a capacitor is supposed to be a pure capacitance. It's not supposed to have any series resistance. But they all do. And the realities of the world mean that you have to deal with crummy parts that are suboptimal. This is pretty close to a real-world example. And maybe not quite as close to real world, unless you get a really large inductor, is X sub L, that has a series of inherent series resistance of 0.22 ohm. The resistance of the capacitor comes, you know, that's built into the capacitor. It's part of it. The resistance that's built into the capacitor comes as a result of the wiring of all the plates to the terminals that are the wires that carry the signal in, and the fact that the plates are made incredibly thin. They don't want to waste any room, because there's got to be lots of plates inside of a capacitor, and so the plates themselves are resistive. So it becomes, you know, there's no way to avoid some resistance. And the same is true of the inductor. You wind the inductor out of coil. It's a wire wound on a bobbin or a spool. And the length of that wire has some resistance that you just can't get rid of. Oh, you can make the inductor bigger using bigger wire and fewer turns and things like that, and you can get the resistance down there. Well, nowadays you can use superconductors, and superconductors have almost no resistance at all. I say almost. Theoretically, they don't have any resistance, but in point of fact, superconductors are only regionally superconductive. So there are regions within them that appear to have resistance, and they do lose. You charge up a coil and short it, it should remain charged forever, but in fact, there are losses, and they do leak off the magnetic field eventually, no matter how hard you try to prevent it. But this is maybe a real-world coil. And so I show the effect of this resonance, and you understand that X sub L, that is the inductive reactance at the frequency, is 100 ohms, and the same goes for X sub C, because it's a resonant circuit. We're trying to hit the frequency that both X sub L and X sub C are matched. That's what makes resonance resonance, so that the two terms are exactly the same. And, of course, they have differing resistances. That's just an inherent characteristic of the device. When you get done with the calculation at the bottom, you end up with something that is 20,000 ohms of pure resistance. And it's slightly inductive. It has an X of L of 12 ohms. Okay, that's a small amount of inductive reactance and a really large amount of resistance. Now, where did that 20,000 ohm come from? That pure resistance of 20,000 ohm. I mean, we had 0.22 ohm, we had 0.28 ohm. Nowhere near 20,000. Well, this is because these are reactive elements that are right at resonance, and there are very interesting things happening here. A 20,000 ohm resistor is not likely to draw very much power out of your generator. If you're standing on the shaft and you're trying to imagine the vector that this thing is going to draw when it's connected, it draws so little that it is almost pure resistance and very high. That's the whole idea of a resonance circuit. You know, a resonance circuit is supposed to behave like a pendulum. You start the thing swinging, and it'll go on swinging forever at that frequency, requiring very little effort to keep it swinging. Similarly, an inductor requires very little effort from the generator when it's at resonance to keep it oscillating. Okay. I hope that this has given you some picture so far. Now I'm going to try and do a simple example for Ohm's law, actually entertaining voltages. See, we've been talking about so far is the impedances, being able to calculate series and parallel and that sort of thing. Now I'm going to show you something that actually has some voltage in it. We're going to do a couple of Ohm's law, but for impedances, and I've made them real simple. I didn't even entertain an inductance yet. You can do that. It just changes all the signs of things if you want. We're going to assume that the generator is producing 10.0 volts. In this case, RMS. It really doesn't matter, other than that the vector looks a little different. X sub C is the reactance of the capacitor at whatever frequency we're running it at. See, I didn't tell you what capacitance C was. If I'd have told you what capacitance C was and given you a frequency, you could have calculated X sub C. But I just gave you X sub C here. I'm assuming that from the previous lessons you figured out how to take a capacitance and turn it into a capacitive reactance if you know what frequency you're applying to it. But here I just give you an X sub C, and I give you an R of 10,000 ohms. And if you actually set up the magnitude and angle, you actually do the rise run and convert it from rise run or rectangular coordinates, and you convert it to polar coordinates, you'll end up with a magnitude of a little bit over 10 k ohm, you know, 10.44 k, with an angle of minus, since it's a capacitance, minus 16.66 something degrees. In other words, that's how many degrees it rotates off of the horizontal axis. Okay. With an in other words, that's the total impedance now. What we've just done is we've summed the X sub C and the R. When you sum them, you end up with the Z magnitude and the Z angle, that becomes your total impedance. Which, to do Ohm's law, you need to be able to calculate the current. So, in the next frame, in figure 13, E sub R, or voltage across the resistor, we're going to solve for the voltage across the resistor, that back on figure 12, that's the figure to the left. The drawing, the diagram, is the figure to the left is the one whose output terminals are connected across the resistor. So that's E sub R of voltage across the resistor. And the one on the right is voltage across the capacitor, or E sub C. All right, so in figure 13, two things are to be calculated in this. E sub r, which is r times I. Pretty simple. E sub c is x sub c times I. Okay, the capacitor reactance times the current. So resistance times the current, capacitor reactance times the current. That'll give you the voltage. Okay, of each one. Okay, so to get current, you divide the voltage of the generator, E sub gen, by the total impedance. Well, the total impedance is that magnitude and angle that I discussed earlier. But I actually show that on the right-hand side at the top of figure 13, where I actually solve for it. I break the problem apart so that you've got the capacitive reactance shown as rectangular, because that's what you started out with, of 3,000Y and no X, and the resistor of no Y and 10,000X. When you add those together, you end up with a rise-run combination of minus 3,000Y and 10,000X, and whenever you convert that to polar coordinates, you end up with, 10,440 at an angle of minus, it's important, minus 16 degrees, or thereabouts. To solve for current, it's the voltage divided by, in this case, the impedance. In other words, that's what Z total is. Z sub T is the impedance of what the generator is seeing. And we end up with an I that is pretty small. You would expect it to be fairly small. 10 divided by some 10,000. At a plus 16. Now, the reason that it's plus is, again, if you go back to the thing where I was showing you how to multiply and divide, when you divide vectors, you subtract the bottom one from the top one, and if you subtract the bottom one, which is minus 16, from the top one, which is 0, you end up with plus 16. The sign reverses. Okay, so now we've got I, the current, and to get E sub R, voltage across the resistor, we multiply R times I, and then I show 10,000 at 0 degrees times 0.00 or 0009 something at 16 degrees, and you end up with 9.57 something volts at 16 degrees. Okay, that's pretty straightforward. Now, in order to get the voltage across the capacitor, E sub C is pretty much the same thing, except it's 3,000 at minus 90 times the current, and you end up with, because you're adding angles now, the minus 90 and the plus 16 give you the minus 73 mumble degrees. Okay, now there ought to be something here that might go off in your head as a kind of an alarm. 9.5 volts, if you just take the magnitude of 9.5 volts and you were to add it to 2.8 volts, you end up with something that is considerably higher than the voltage you started with. Your generator is only putting in 10 volts. So how is it possible to get higher voltages when you add them together than you provided the circuit to start with? Well, you can get this because they're not at the same time. If you were to look at these voltages standing on the end of that generator, one of the voltages is 9.5 volts at a positive 16 degrees. In other words, if you're standing there on that generator whirling around, it is shooting out from you almost as far away as the vector that is the 10 volts, but it's shooting out a little bit to your left, at 16 degrees to your left, and it's a little bit shorter than the original 10 volts, it's 9.5 volts. Fine. And if you look way over to your right, almost directly to your right, there's a little short vector that's real close to you, it's 2.5 volts, at minus 73 degrees. Notice that the two of them, the 16.9 and the 73 degrees, are 90 degrees apart. What this is telling you is that the voltage of, in other words, if you were to look at each one of these voltages on an oscilloscope, the voltage across the resistor is 90 degrees out of phase with the voltage on the capacitor. And if you imagine yourself standing on the end of this generator shaft, spinning around, the world spinning around you, but since you're rotating with the generator, you can imagine how this voltage at this magnitude to your left, that's almost the length of the original vector that the generator is producing, you can imagine that voltage at the magnitude to your left and the voltage over here that's lagging behind, because you're rotating towards your left all the time. The one that's lagging behind, that's lagging to your right, that one, because those are not, those two voltages are not at the same, their phase is different. Effectively, their timing is different. And if you were to take that voltage that's shooting out to your right, the 2.8 volts, and you were to attach it to the end of this vector that's shooting out slightly to your left and out to 9.5, and you were to intersect those two vectors together, they would meet at the 10 volts that is the generator itself. Okay, so they do really add up to the total generator voltage. But if you measure them on a meter, you'll get separately, one at a time, you'll get voltages that if you were to add them up, come out more than the generator is producing. But because there's a temporal shift, a phase shift in this, the only way you can really see that they do add up is to do the vector math, and they do. I hope it's been an interesting one, and I suggest strongly that you carry out the examples that I've given you here, and maybe get a hold of a book if you're weak on this subject, and do some of the examples in the book. Give yourself a good firm grasp of this stuff, because you'll probably never see it again until you're way late in your career someday, and you're going to sit there, I remember there was a way to do this, but how do I do it? That happens to me, believe it or not, and there's nothing you can do about it, but the more experience you have at calculating these things while you're at this stage, the better you will understand it. And there just really isn't any way for me to prepare you other than, limited space of a web page and so forth. There really isn't any way for me to prepare you beyond telling you that if you feel really weak in this area, to get yourself some textbooks or something that have solutions in them, and test yourself. Maybe at some point, if I get students, sending me back nice examples, I might post some of them on the website someplace where people can look them over and do some of the examples. That might be a useful thing. But at present, I don't have any. It takes time to grind these out, and I've got other things to do here. So wish you the best of luck.